This is IT Visionaries, your number one source for actionable insights and exclusive interviews with CIOs, CTOs, and CISOs, and many more. I'm your host, Albert Chow, a former CIO, former sales VP, and now podcast host. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IT Visionaries. And today we have a special guest. His name is Steve Stone, and he's got a unique title. He is the head of Zero Labs at a company called Rubrik. That's spelled R-U-B-R-I-K. They don't make cubes. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Albert. Really stoked to be here. Excited to jump in.
You listen, I had to add that because I've mentioned on the show many times that my son is an avid speed cuber, right? But your Rubrik, the company, has nothing to do with the cubes. Tell us, what is Rubrik and what do you guys do?
Yeah, so we don't have anything to do with the cubes, but you might be able to see it on my shelf back there. One of our favorite swag items is a Rubrik cube. So we're a big fan of the cubes as well. So Rubrik is a data security company. And I would say that effectively we do two things and we always do them in step one, step two. Step one, we want to back up and secure as much of an organization's data as possible so it's able to be recovered and it's fully immutable, it's fully protected. That's always step one. And then step two is, once we've secured that data, what we've learned in about our 10-year corporate journey is there's a lot of analytics and workflow we can provide once we have done that offline backup. So we can do things like sensitive data discovery. We can look at orchestrated workflow to make it an automated process. We can actually test recovery processes. We can give data security evaluations. So that second step is effectively, what are the kinds of analytics and workflows we can provide to organizations to help them be a better focused data security organization? So step one, I make it sound very easy, back up and secure as much data as possible. That's a very challenging thing for the engineers. We're talking on-premises, we're talking cloud, we're talking SaaS, we're talking about a bunch of nuance inside of all that. But once we've done that, we then want to do as many of the productive analytics and workflows on top of that data. So that's Rubrik in a nutshell.
Let's use an example so that our audience can better understand this. Let's use Mission. So Mission creates podcasts. We create video feeds, audio feeds, generally high data, big files. We load to cloud. We also have local machines that have this data. We're a fully remote company. Some of our team members have, you know, we've had workers working on our stuff in Nepal, for example. And so we're scattered everywhere. So let's say disaster hits. You mentioned the first thing is backup recovery. So that understand completely. Give us an idea. Let's imagine something happens to us. We're victims to an attack.
Yep. I think there's two scenarios that I would highlight what we do as a company. And I apologize. I don't want this to be a Rubrik sales pitch. I'm actually designed to be vendor agnostic, but I think the mechanisms give a lot of visibility into how we approach the world. So I think the first scenario is like the cyber attack. Let's say your organization deals with ransomware. All of a sudden, all of your environment's encrypted and you don't even know where to begin. One of the things that often is overlooked in a ransomware event is how hard it is to make sense of an event when everything's encrypted and people can't access your data and your systems. So the main things we do there is, can you recover it? Can we just say, let's move this data from point A to point B and move past this encryption event? What's really important inside of that, though, is making sure you move the right pile of data. So you don't want to recover the attackers because they're in your environment. So you want to go back to the last snapshot right before an attack happened. You also want to balance that with, you don't go too far back and lose a bunch of data that you don't need to. So if the attacker have had access for 6 days, you want to go back to that 7th day so you don't recover the attackers, but you don't want to have to go back 45 days and lose that plus 38 days of data that you don't need to. That's an unnecessary business burden. So that's really kind of scenario one. And there's a bunch of stuff inside that. I can already hear like our engineers and our field teams being like, oh, there's a million more things to say there. But that's basically it. Give visibility into your data estate based on the backups so you can make the right decision to move over the right data at the right time and get back to your business. The second scenario we would say is, what are the daily tasks that can make an organization more resilient? So you mentioned having like folks in Nepal, you mentioned like yourself. One of the things that we do in a daily task as well as crisis is we actually say, this user is accessing this types of data. So you, Albert, probably routinely access a pretty insignificant part of your total data estate. Your folks in Nepal are probably accessing a totally different part. We can actually map users to data and say, you've got a bunch of sensitive data. You've got a bunch of regulatory data that you have to do all these things for, but no one's touched it in a year. Maybe you don't need this and you want to delete it out. Or Albert all of a sudden 2 days ago started accessing source code. Why is Albert doing that? You might want to look into that. It might be a malicious insider. It might be that you're just curious. It might be that your account became compromised by a hacker. So there's a lot of things around that. And probably the best, most tangible example I'll give for any of this is sensitive data. We have the ability to measure sensitive data against the offline backups because we can run very computationally intensive and expensive analytics against the offline backup, and no one cares because it doesn't affect your production environment. And we can actually move across your cloud. You probably have a couple, actually. Most organizations are actually multi-cloud. You're using a SaaS app. You've got, you know, your local host. We can see across all that and say, here's all the sensitive data. And now your organization can make the right decisions on, is this the right amount? Is it where it's supposed to be? Who's accessing it? And make daily resiliency discussions and decisions. And then also that crisis, there's a disaster, there's a hack, and we need our data back.
Talk a little bit about your role, because you have a pretty cool title. You guys have, a named team. You are the head of Zero Labs. What is Zero Labs at Rubrik?
Yeah, so Zero Labs is our threat research element here at Rubrik. And we are assigned three distinct tasks. The first is we're tasked with operationalizing evil finding, effectively saying, can we find bad actors, whether that's insiders, outside, external attackers, whatever the case may be, can we find those entities affecting both Rubrik and our particular technology types? We can definitely come back to that. There's a lot of stuff inside there, but we do that first and foremost. Second thing we do is then say, we've understood these things through research, we've identified problems, we can see anomalies, whatever the case may be, and now we want to help organizations reduce their risk. And the way I would effectively say is, we're not here to be the bad news people. We're not here to say, hey, there's a real problem. Good luck with that. We're actually here to say, there's a real problem here, and you should do this, or our product teams need to build out this net new feature, or our engineers need to think about the way we engineer our backend. There's a range of things there to reduce that risk. And then the third task we do is really combine those two things and then be that trusted security advisor on behalf of Rubrik out into the larger cybersecurity communities, the data security communities, and then also bring those communities back to Rubrik. So we're really designed to be vendor agnostic. We're designed to look at topics and threats and then make sure that those findings get converted in a range of ways on behalf of Rubrik. So that's really what we're here to do in a nutshell.
For audience, give it a click when you go check out their website. It's in the upper right-hand corner. It says Rubrik Zero Labs. And the way I would describe it is it starts off, the experience is a bunch of informative dynamic infographics, I think is the best way to describe it. As you click through, you get to make decisions and trees, and you get to learn, industry-wide information that helps you identify or understand, the landscape, kind of like what you hinted at before. One of the factoids here is about IT. There's IT and security leaders feel about their ability to manage risk. And it sounds like globally, only 66% of people feel confident. They believe their data growth has already outpaced their ability to secure data and manage risk. So only 66% of IT leaders feel that way. That sounds low. That feels low to me. Why do you think that is?
So I think there's a few things there. And the way we approach everything from Zero Labs is from a data perspective. We're not really here to talk about infrastructure or the more traditional cybersecurity pieces. So we're very data biased, and I want to be very upfront about that. So our answers aren't so much better or worse than. We want to really kind of augment those more traditional cybersecurity views and talk about data. So when we talk about that statistic you just mentioned, we engaged with over 1,600 organizations that were not Rubrik clients. Mm-hmm. We wanted an external, unbiased viewpoint. And we asked primarily CIOs and CISOs, what are you struggling with? And there's a lot more inside that. But effectively, two out of three of them came back and said, I'm not confident we can manage business risk because primarily our data is growing so fast. So yeah. What I think is inside there is really three distinct things. I think one is data is just exploding. I think when we look at data, probably the single largest threat about data is just how fast it's growing and the stresses that puts on defenders and regulatory teams. The second thing we see, and I kind of just buried the lead there, is data, in particular data security, is really no one team's job. You end up with these coalition of the willing. You end up with lots of people with kind of one foot in, one foot out, and it's kind of their problem, kind of not. And that makes it challenging. I don't know any organization on any topic that wants that to be the preferred model. They want an owner, they want to know who it is, and they want to be able to support that owner. But that's another challenge. And then the third is, we talk a lot about risk, because when we really look at data, it's much more about risk versus the threat specifics. Risk is a tough topic because it's ultimately a business topic. So now we're talking about security, we're talking about IT, we're actually talking about business, and that mix and that understanding organizations really struggle with because it's really complicated. And I kind of describe it as a Q5 task. It's no one's today job. It's always like, we want to do that, we'll get to it next quarter. Well, it's always next quarter. And there's just hair on fire challenges to solve. So this is a big topic for us. How do we really help organizations understand risk and help get their arms around it?
So there's an interesting thing you were talking about, and like the idea of data creation and how it's being created so fast that we can't really keep up with it. And traditionally it was always, it's always probably came from a person, but now with AI and generative AI, the machine itself can be creating the data, which becomes a wholly unique challenge. I think, if we think back 5 years ago, you're talking about maybe a team wants to open a new gateway to gather data or collect data from a customer or to create a new experience for customers. And it just so happens to collect data that maybe wasn't unaccounted for, as you mentioned. You know, those were challenges then. How is the industry, or how are you guys thinking about how do you also monitor generative AI created data? Because it is creating, like, to me, the biggest topic at hand is actually the topic of veracity. You know, like, should this be created? Does it need to be stored? Is it coming from a good actor? I don't even know if actor is the word anymore, but I think about how does AI know it has data that it should have access to? That's my, I guess my chicken or egg kind of question. How are you guys approaching that?
Great question. We could talk all day on that. I love that topic. Yeah. So let me kind of start and end with AI. And then I want to kind of talk about data just a little bit in the middle. The short answer to the question is, we don't differentiate AI generated data from, we just want to look at it as data. Now we want to understand what's creating data, but that's kind of the short answer is, to us, data is data. The little bit longer answer around AI is, there's three specific things that we think about with AI. One is, the entire value prop of AI is it can grok through very large data sets and present novel solutions to that. So as important as data is yesterday or was yesterday, it's even more important tomorrow because of AI. You cannot have AI without large piles of data. It just doesn't work.
Yep.
So that's number one. The two are now intrinsically tied. Number two, very much to your comment, AI, especially generative AI, now has the ability to create data based on what it has access to. So there's now a need for this very granular understanding of data. Are your AI models accessing the right data? And then what are they producing, and how is that adding to this already large pile? The third thing that we think about for AI in particular is AI, there's lots of concerns about AI hallucinations, poisoning the data well, all these things. If AI is effectively this model running across a pile of data, how do you know that pile of data is what you think it is? It's the right kinds of data, which you can verify. It's secure, and bad actors or even innocent attempts, and all of a sudden you have a bad line of code or production outages. There's all these challenges that can now affect that data pile. You have to secure it. Otherwise, your entire AI output is at risk. So it really complicates and accelerates this already tough problem of data growth, which we could talk about for a whole other day. That's probably the single thing I talk about the most. But AI is really accelerating these challenges and making them more important at the exact same time.
When we ran a software company, one of the things that customers always wanted was they wanted the counts of comments. So we ran a social media management company. They wanted to count up like, well, how many people are talking to us about, you know, Oreo wanted to know how many people like this new packaging or new campaign or whatever. And they'd want counts of this. And so what we figured out was, of course, if you counted it and you stored the value every day, it was easier to count the counts. You know what I mean? Like, so we're basically every single, we're making augmentations, and that's how databases keep growing. For those listening, it's like every time you find a new solution, we store that in memory. It was much easier, much faster experience. Customers are happy. Boom. Okay. Like you just said, you just created a new data layer, right? Every time we're creating data layers, but now we have generative AI also creating data layers. I guess, you know, in Moore's law, I think has been broken for a while now, meaning like we're actually creating more than the timetables of Moore's law are off, right? We're just creating exponentially more. What does that mean for you guys? Because you want to be able to capture it all, recognize when bad actors play a part, restore as much as possible. How are you guys approaching this problem? Because it doesn't feel like the answer can just be, oh, you just have to buy more hardware. You just can't, because that's the only way. You like continuously have to access more services and hardware in order to even collect all this information. It's a problem that seems to be growing faster than the value it's creating, I guess is what I'm getting at. Like, give me an idea of how you guys are approaching that so it doesn't become that.
Yeah. So this is the topic I talk about the most. Like, just what are the actual data estates and what are they doing? And I probably should take a step back. I come to Rubrik from very much a specific slice of the cybersecurity community. My career in the US military, the intelligence community, and then private sector has always been really at the crossroads between threat intelligence and event response, whether that's IR, MDR, and where those two worlds meet. So I'm very much coming from the threat side of it and how that works. And that's my background. And that's what I came to Rubrik to do. And what I've learned at Rubrik in about the 18 months I've been here is we actually have to step all the way back. Data is so poorly understood that we really have to work our way into how are we going to effectively defend it and then secure it. So it's been interesting. And this data growth topic is far and away the biggest thing that we talk about. So with that kind of little bit of a scene setting, here's how we approach it. The first is we want to provide visibility into the data estate. One of the things that we're able to do based on taking the offline backups is we get an excellent view of whatever the organization's backing up. I'm kind of a big dumb animal. I'm used to doing like forensic images. That's where I started years and years ago. You'd walk, you'd make a forensic image of a hard drive. You'd walk to another one and then you take them to your lab and you jam them all in. And then we built EDR technology. We built network sensors and we did it remotely. I look at an offline backup. It's the exact same thing. It's the largest forensic image you can possibly take. So all the things you can understand with those traditional viewpoints, you can with here, but we're almost on the front end of that, as weird as that sounds. So the first step is visibility. Most organizations, in my experience, both before Rubrik and at Rubrik, have no concept for their data estate. So let's say you're Albert Yacito. Over 25 years, I'm very used to showing up and saying, all right, Albert, we've got either we're going to try to proactively solve a problem or we got a breach. How many hosts do you have? CISOs know that answer.
No idea.
How many employees do you have? Like, they can answer. But then I say, well, how much data are you securing? The room gets really quiet. If you ask an organization, how much sensitive data do you have? Most organizations cannot answer that. And I'm not trying to play stump the dummy in organizations. It's just, that's a brass tacks reality. So we start first with visibility. Let's show an organization, here is your data estate. The second thing we try to do is combine that visibility across the realities of a modern organization, which means it's hybrid. I have never in my entire experience seen an entirely on-premises organization or an entirely cloud organization. Like, it just doesn't work that way. So organizations are hybrid, and understanding that hybrid element is really challenging. So we want to then go after that. The third thing we want to do is now say, we've effectively set a baseline. What is the delta for that baseline? Where is it going and moving? And that, I think, is from a defender viewpoint. One of the biggest surprises is we're used to saying, I'm defending this. Here's my boundary. And wherever I put it yesterday is where it's at today. Data is exploding. The boundary, wherever you thought it was yesterday, it's somewhere different tomorrow. And it's moving faster than anything else. So That's why we talk data growth so much, is we want to set those baselines so now we can get to the defender work and then go to town.
All right. So now I got to ask, because you said you meet the leaders, you try to figure out where this data is. So how do you find what you don't know exists? Like that's the, you know, that's because if I was a leader and I could point you, oh, we use, you know, these are our, for example, these are our Azure instances, but you with experience probably know that whatever Azure instances I think exist under my company, you probably like, hey, you probably actually have more than that.
And absolutely.
Like, I don't know what you mean.
We see it all the time. What you said, we see it daily.
Yeah. How do you know what you don't know? Or how do you find what I don't know exists? That's my big, because you are doing this in order to get that landscape.
So I think that the simple answer, which is not easy, but the simple answer to say is, from our perspective, whatever is backed up, we can now evaluate. So that's why it's so important, those two steps. We always want to be data greedy and back it up so now we can see more. And then we go through the analytics. We've also, at Rubrik, we recently acquired a company called Laminar. They were primarily in the DSPM space, data security posture management. We acquired that company because as we looked at where data is going, we can see these macro trends and also the micro trends. Everyone's accelerating in the cloud and SaaS. That's no surprise. We needed more technology to be able to do that quicker. Very much to your point, like, well, I've got 3 Azure instances. Actually, you've got 7. So how do we do that discovery? Yeah. Is important enough for us that we went out and did the largest acquisition in our company history to solve like that exact problem. We needed technology to say, we can see a bunch doing these offline backups, but we need to move faster, primarily in the cloud, and then help close these gaps in real time. Like, and the Azure stuff's a perfect example. We see that literally daily. We'll deploy Laminar in cloud and they'll say, well, we've got 3 cloud instances. And we'll say, actually, you've got 7. 4 of them are wide open to the internet. How about we hit this button and solve that? Like, a lot of these problems are actually very technically easy to solve once the visibility is solved.
Yeah.
So we focus a lot in that space and then trying to say, these are the meaningful solutions. I've spent most of my career doing the high-end solutions, like 98% to 100%. Most of the real value is like, we can go from 0 to 85% in 30 seconds. So let's do that. Mm. And now let's chip away at the 85 to 90%, 90 to 95%. And there's lots of ways that we do that, but that's the biggest thing. Let's understand the data estate. Let's make sure it's what we think it is. Let's secure the easy parts. And now let's get to the hard work. And again, I make that sound very simple, but it's pretty complicated.
Yeah, because I'm imagining all these fringe cases, because I think to myself about how certain development shops, they have their, let's say their top teams have the ability to spin up their own instances, infrastructure. All it takes is one person to take their P card, their company credit card to open up access to a new service that maybe no one has tried before. Let's just say, like, you know, come, you know, there's a new service called, you know, Y, and people are like, oh, I want to use Y. And, you know, so someone throws down their company credit card, starts pumping data into Y, starts sending data back. At what level are you examining? Because I, when you first started talking, I immediately thought, oh, I wonder if they go through credit cards and just instantly, based on credit card spends, can see like what services are in play, because that would show up. But you mentioned you look at it from a different way, which is like, I guess, what is adding to overall databases, repositories, application data that's flowing through. You're trying to find different sources. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So, and again, I'm going to make the engineers freak out because I'm going to make it sound really easy and it's not, but we want to go where the data is. So we've got to be a bunch of places. So you've got to be able to back up and then evaluate, you know, Oracle and MongoDB, and you've got to be in all the cloud instances, and you've got to be in the databases and the data, you know, the servers. You've got to do all of that. And also same thing with cloud and SaaS. We've then got to make a number of decisions. The types of data we want to have access to and secure is always longer than we can actually do. There's just more technology in more places, and that list will never be empty. So we have to make a lot of prioritization decisions on what comes next. And we do that based on two things. One is we look at where we see data going and where it is. We don't ever want to move off of where it actually is. So like I've mentioned already, like people are going to cloud and SaaS, but they're not moving off of on-prem either. So we can't move away from those very legacy traditional data storage locations. We then also want to evaluate, where do we think the most important data is residing. And that might not always be the same list as where people are saying, I need this data backed up. And I'll give a good example. We recently rolled out the ability to back up, secure, and then do analytics against Atlassian. So Confluence and Jira. And I'll be really kind of transparent. And we didn't have a lot of customers asking us for that. They were asking us for other stuff.
Yeah.
The number of people saying, I need my Atlassian secured is just not real long. Our product team and our research actually kind of paired together and said, if we look at the data that's there and we look at the work that is being done, if you lose Atlassian or you can't make the right granular decisions on that data, organizations will not be able to work. So most people and most organizations have never used Jira. They just haven't. But almost every organization is using Jira for critical stuff like source code deployment, bug fixes, customers, like really critical workflows.
Bug fixes for sure.
Yeah. So yeah. Imagine running a modern engineering organization today. If I turned off Jira and Confluence tomorrow, there's going to be really profound problems.
Yeah. You wouldn't know what to do next. Like literally, like you have a table of things you were supposed to do, let's say in the next week. You're like, there's no way anyone can remember what they were.
Exactly. So we made a very conscious decision to say, we're going to spend engineering capability to build this out, even though most people aren't asking us for this because we think it's critical from a workflow perspective. And then to kind of pair the Zero Lab stuff, we're seeing lots of attackers. They're very comfortable in cloud. They're very comfortable in SaaS. So that's contested space. They also really prefer those environments because it's basically valid access. And attackers have always loved valid access. They will always heavily pivot towards valid access. So it's not academic anymore that we're seeing attackers intentionally go after Jira and Confluence. And those are blind spots for security teams. Most security teams can't really see what's happening there. And we want to bring that capability as well. So it's this mix of where do we think the data is? Where do we think it's going? What are the critical workflows for that data? And now let's layer threat realities on top of that. And then we make decisions on we're going to do this next and we'll not do that. It's always a trade-off. So we want to make those decisions as informed as possible.
You opened the door to a subject that I want to ask you about. When I was at a software company that was monitoring what people were doing on their websites, we had to be installed, of course, on websites. And I remember the bigger companies, of course, were much more stringent about what we were doing on their website. So, for example, we tried to close Walmart, specifically Sam's Club. And Sam's Club, they put our application through really rigorous tests. And every enterprise company kind of did that. Like they put us through rigorous testing to see like, how are we using the data? How are we transferring? What are we collecting, before they could say, yes, you can work with us. But the smaller companies didn't have this need or, requirement. They probably had the need. They didn't have the requirement. And we know today that a modern application layer, you already hinted at it, is really a compilation of, I don't even know how many services, microservices, SaaSes come together for any company to deliver one user experience. It's mind-boggling now. Like I don't envy that task. So you're only as strong as your weakest link. How does your team approach that problem? Because you talked about proliferation, David, but there's also the proliferation of providers. In a lot of companies, especially small to medium-sized companies, they kind of just trust the provider. Because they don't really have a way to verify that the provider is doing everything perfectly good. You know what I mean? Or perfectly to their standard or security standard or whatever their standard could be. They kind of just have to say, yeah, I'll install, for example, Hotjar, which is it tracks like what users are doing on your website, like or Google Analytics or name any company. It doesn't matter. Like they kind of have to have that trust. How do you guys approach solving that problem? Because that's every company's problem.
Yeah, it's a deeply profound problem. Like all cards on the table. I think for any tech company, that's probably the largest problem they're facing or will face. Clients are giving us access to their single most precious asset, which is their data. So it's all caps true for us. Not that it's not true for other organizations, but like we don't get to turn away from this. This is problem number 1, 2, and 3. And then we get to the rest of the stuff. So we tackle that 3 distinct ways. The first is, I would love to claim credit for this, but the original founders 10 years ago made incredibly smart engineering decisions on our core platform. So we take very seriously that we will not inject any risk into our clients. And also, we just know we're going to lean into all of these pressures because we don't get to turn away from it. This is a question we'll always be asked. And it your point's dead on. Like, the big companies and governments tend to know this pretty well. The smaller, newer ones don't, but they end up getting to it. So we're just going to solve that on day one. And the company literally did. So we get to ride the wave of some incredibly smart engineering decisions and some non-negotiables. So the first thing is we're always immutable. The data that we back up and access, like, we can't even access it. So it actually causes challenges for us at times. That quest to say this engineering will hold up. It will be immutable and it's non-negotiable. And I'll give two examples. One is we have a number of clients that say, hey, listen, we would love you to store our keys and secrets. And then we just know it's safe somewhere. And we say, absolutely not. We cannot keep this standard if we do that. And that causes problems. That's not always well received, but we cannot inject risk to that central plank. Or another example is we have the ability to identify malicious files. We can threat hunt against offline backups and now say, hey, organization X, you've got a ransomware deployment tool inside your data holdings there. And they say, that's awesome. You found it. Can you delete it out? No, we can't access your data. It's immutable. And that's an uncomfortable conversation, but the first and most important thing we do is we have to make sure the engineering to secure this data is non-negotiable. And so that's easily far and away the biggest thing that we focus on. The second thing we focus on is how do we make organizations more aware of these pressures and these gaps? Where is their regulatory data? GDPR, you can't talk regulatory anything and not talk GDPR. Now we're talking DORA. The ability to identify that and say, this part of your data estate, and oh, by the way, here's the part of the technology it sits in, you now need to know there's GDPR here, there's HIPAA there. We spend a lot of time surfacing that capability. So now organizations can start getting after this. The third thing we do, and this is the one where honestly it takes the longest time with organizations, is we want to be able to say, let's actually test this. It's great to say, here it is. It's great to have a spreadsheet that now you can download and say, here's all my stuff. But to your point, like, I need to make sure this works, or there's a thing that I don't know. We spend a lot of time building in functionality to say, all right, go hit these buttons and it's not going to break anything in production because it's in your offline backups. You can effectively test your process and figure out, and organizations do all the time, like, oh, we thought this was going to work and we actually missed four critical applications, or the sequencing was wrong, or this, and I'm sure this will speak to you in your experience with IT, there's always the sticky note on a server somewhere in a data farm that, like, someone wrote in 1999 and everyone lost the ball on, and it's a critical piece of information. All those things get surfaced when you're actually pressing buttons versus writing a plan in a Word document. So those are the three general areas that we work on solving those issues with.
The sticky notes is we've been there. I worked at a cloud networking company. Yeah. I worked at a cloud networking company, and there were times where people were like, well, no one knows how to configure this machine. It's password protected. Like, well, where's the password? It was on the machine. Yep. Like,
we
like,
see only all the time.
Guy. Yep. Only the person who can configure this switch has to be there. So it's it's more common than you would think. I think most people don't realize. I guess the next question is more industry based. You know, how fast does it become a problem? So, like, for example, there's a lot of companies, of course, that are, you know, smaller, and maybe I don't know what the right number is, but like, it's just not as securing the data isn't as important. Maybe like like you said, it's like a Q5 project. They're not too worried about it. How fast does it, I guess, it become a problem? Is it like, do you kind of consistently see like, hey, if you're a software company, like, it's when you have at least 100 customers, or you're a CPG company, it's like when you launch your consumer app. Like, when does a small company start realizing, hey, I need to do something?
They usually realize that there's a problem to be solved when it's now their single biggest problem and it's their only problem they're focused on. So it's not a problem until all of a sudden it is now the Widowmaker problem, or they're seeing that happen to one of their peers or competitors. It is not uncommon that we will have this academic organization you're describing. It's very common. we're a new kind of company or we're going in a new area, happens all the time. And they're like, we need to get smart on this. Usually the reason they want to get smart is they just watched their near peer completely fall down and now it's all on fire. And they say, we don't want that to be us. How do we do this? So it's usually that. It's usually, oh man, this is a company ending event that we're either in or we do not want to be in. And the we try to really help organizations understand that crisis moment in a very realistic, pragmatic way. We're not here to freak anybody out, but these are potentially really scary topics. But the flip side and the piece we always try to emphasize is these can be scary, but these are all also deeply solvable problems. These are things that like you can really eliminate whole swaths. You can improve by an order of magnitude relatively cheaply, relatively quickly, and de-risk a lot of this, but it's got to be intentional. So there's a lot of bad news, but there's even more good news, as inverse as that sounds.
My best analogy for this is like, it's very much like cardiology. You know what I mean? Like, of course, yes, bad things can happen, but if you also prepare for it, it's not that hard to protect. It's also very easy to protect yourself from a catastrophic cardiac, cardio event. And, the way you were saying it, and I agree, like they, I can see how companies, I don't want to say falter, but like, yeah, it's not a problem until it's a problem. And sometimes they, whether it's news or something else, it becomes a bigger problem. Well, you know, it's been fun having you on the show. The problem that you are attacking, it's just not going away. Like you, the data proliferation, continuously securing, it's not going to go away. I want to close with this. Do you ever see a way where it gets materially easier? Like, so one of the things that that people have hypothesized in the future is going to be proactive AIs that handle cybersecurity possibly for me. You know what I mean? Like where I'm not and this is not quite in the rubric domain, but like, you know, like the having bots or like instead of having error logs and a person going to check, I'm like, no, we just have, I don't know, bots is the best way to describe it, constantly going out and proactively stopping threats, closing loops, grabbing instances that it's identified, securing it, storing it proactively, like almost like soldiers, like kind of like marching for you without people. Do you see a world where that's happening?
I see a world where it can happen. I think that's a much more accessible future through a range of technologies. And here's kind of what I mean by that is, I think it's always been about data, either business power or threat actor impact, always been about data, both those things, and that will never go away. So a big thing that we advocate for is let's approach it that way. And we're not saying move off of more traditional cybersecurity or IT business efficiency. Those things are important. But why are we not spending more of our time talking about the thing that we all know is the most powerful and the most dangerous to us? So let's make first things first. So that's the first thing I'd say. And once we start doing that, a bunch of solutions shake out pretty quickly. The question on AI is a really good one because I think it's a good exemplar of how a bunch of technologies can be used. So we use AI in two ways at Rubrik, and neither one of these sound that crazy, but they work. One is we use AI to do a bunch of these analytics. I've mentioned sensitive data a bunch of times. AI is great at that, and that's what we use it for. We use AI models to grok through these incredibly large data sets and then find sensitive data. AI technology has been really good at that for a number of years. That's not a new thing, you know, since OpenAI really kicked the hornet's nest over. That's always been there. So we use it to do the things that are really hard to do manually, but the machines do really, really well. The second thing we use AI for, and we're finding a lot of power here, and we're just kind of in the front of this, is I won't dive into a bunch of the details. I mentioned like we back the data up and now we do these analytics. We ran into a very profound problem. Every one of those analytics was effectively different teams. So we actually built an AI tool to say, you're probably a backup admin, and we're just now telling you you've got threat activity in your backup. That backup admin, he or she, probably doesn't know what to do with that. So now you're losing time because you're Googling stuff, you're trying to figure it out. We actually use AI to say, this does that. It's all inside of your, in this case, Rubrik data holdings. And do you know you can do this? Or here's what this actually means. So we're using AI to identify a bunch of stuff. And then we're actually using AI to literally bring teams together and say, you're probably this persona. We love talking personas in tech. You are this persona doing this work. You're probably not prepared for what we just told you. let's now use AI to bridge to the next persona, or just say, hit this button and let's leverage and highlight decisions you can make with your technology. Super solvable. And now we see decisions happening much quicker. And that helps. That's real resilience, is closing these time deltas. So we're not getting too cute with it, but it really, really works. It's really effective. So I think that that future is really attainable. We've got to be smart about it. There isn't a silver bullet, but there's lots of these things that we can do to solve whole swaths of problems.
That's the the holy grail thing people always want to get to. Because when you think about cybersecurity in the past, it was always, hey, before you identify attack, like if I use like a malware bytes or McAfee, if I go back in time, right? Someone, they had to know what it is so that they could recognize it. Then what'll be crazy is, or I think this is the fingers crossed everyone wants to get to, is like where you can just recognize that this is foreign. You know what I mean? And then say like, hey, that we're going to solve it at the proactively. That'll be a crazy time period when that happens. Steve, I want to say thank you for joining us today on IT Visionaries. I got to ask a couple questions about you. Have you always been into data and security, or was this something that you learned later in your career?
Yeah. So I'm going to give a pretty embarrassing answer here. I have not always been in security, and I'm only recently learning about data. So my background is about as far away from all this as you can get. I was in the service. I was a special agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And I did, you know, felony investigations. I did counter espionage. And I spent most of my career in counterterrorism in special operations. My job was finding people and bringing our capabilities to remove people from threat parts of the world. So you couldn't have found someone farther away from tech than me. And I hated it. I was not interested at all.
You weren't interested in tech and cybersecurity at the time?
Nope, none of it. I had no experience in it. I had no desire. You just could not have found someone farther afield from all of this than me. But I ended up doing it because I ended up being assigned to be a case agent for what we now know are some of the large Chinese government espionage efforts against the US government. And I became the case agent of these really profound international events. Not because I was qualified. I wasn't. Not because I was trained. I definitely wasn't. I was a badge and credentialed federal agent, and I had enough security clearances because of what I was doing in special operations. And all of a sudden, when you're in the service, you do what you're told. And I was told to go work these cases because I was the only person that had the two criteria to get into the right room. And so that kind of began this, this meandering journey along the way. And I got into data when I came to Rubrik. I've got, 15, 20 years in cybersecurity. I've grown to love it. I'm not a tech person. I don't do tech in my off hours, but I've grown to really love the work. And I came to Rubrik because you see over and over and over again, you're solving the same problems. And a lot of the solves are inaccessible. The things you wish you could do are inaccessible. And so I've spent all this time watching data be the end goal and the most important thing. But you spend all this effort working your way there. And at Rubrik, I had an opportunity to start at the data and then meet my peers and the other parts of the industry in the middle. And that was really exciting. So I'm about 18 months into being a data expert. I hate to say that because I'm definitely not. But applying all these skill sets to data, because let's not work our way there. Let's start there and try to solve some of these big problems.
Well, that is pretty cool. I had to ask about it because your background on, of course, I looked at your LinkedIn, right? Like special agent, senior Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Like, what is, man, that sounds like this guy interrogates people. I don't know. And that's right.
That's what I did. Yeah. And it's interesting. This space is full of ex-OSI agents that were trained for this. I mean, you've got Kevin Mandia, he founded Mandia. And you've got Wendy Whitmore of our Palo Alto Networks, Unit 42. I could just go on and on and on. This space is full of them. I was not that agent. I was often the person that was like, hey, nerds, what's going on in nerd school? And now all these people run the industry. So watch who you call nerds, because it could really come back to bite you.
Well, what's interesting is like intent and motivation is like, it's still part of like, I don't know. I've talked to other cybersecurity experts who talk about this. Like you kind of have to understand like what they want to accomplish and how they want to accomplish it to begin where to start looking. And I thought that was pretty fascinating.
It's been a wild ride. I've loved this space.
Thank you for joining us today on IT Visionaries, sharing some of the things that are happening at Rubrik, sharing a little bit about your background. Your background is pretty darn cool. You seem fired up when I talk to you, so you seem like the right guy for the job.
I love this stuff, Albert. I appreciate you having me on. And if you ever want a recurring guest, let me know. I'll always come back and pontificate.
There we go. Till next time, thanks for listening to IT Visionaries.